Connection.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In 1997, Tom McDonough traveled to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. His wife, a photographer, was there to conduct a seminar with Saudi women. One of the participants was a celebrated, controversial, and charismatic novelist named Raja Alem. Raja and her sister, Shadia, invited Tom and his wife over to dinner, and in the course of the meal, a collaboration was born. Tom returned to his home in rural New York with three manuscripts of novels by Raja, written in dense and dictionary-informed English. With his creative assistance, one of those, Fatma, will be published in the United States this January. Well, it's not quite as simple as it may sound. Raja's novels don't follow the rules or the logic of the usual Western narrative. In fact, they make American publishers a little bit nervous. How much difference, they ask, can our readers handle? Well, Connection listeners, you decide. Is Raja's novel the ultimate cross-cultural collaboration or a window into absolute unfamiliarity? Is Raja's Saudi Arabia what you imagine? And in light of the problematic relationship these days between the U.S. and Saudi rulers, can fiction transcend other barriers to communication? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, I'm joined in the studio today by Raja's co-author, Tom McDonough. And Raja Alem is with us by telephone from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Hi, Raja.
Hi.
Thanks for being with us. I'm not sure what I should say on this Eid Mubarak day, the day that you end the fast of Ramadan. Is there a way that you greet people on this day?
No, only say the same. Happy Eid, and that's it.
You're having your feast today, then, are you?
Yes, for 4 days.
Sounds like a lot of sitting around.
Yes, because it is late now. Everybody's out.
Raja, we're glad to have you with us. I want to turn to Tom in the studio here and pick up that story of the collaboration. You weren't handed Arabic script. You were handed what was already a novel written in English by Raja.
That's right. If I had been handed Arabic, I would not have known what to make of it, since I speak or read not a word of it. Actually, in the beginning, Raja handed me one manuscript. The other two came somewhat later, and this was on
was this the secret of all secrets? Is that the
that's
first
right.
one you got?
That's right, Haza, the secret of all secrets. That's the first one. And this handing over the manuscript happened on the last night of my stay there, and we had been there about 2 weeks, and it was a sort of frustrating experience for me, because it's not as if one can just do a lot of strolling around and sightseeing in that part of the world. So when I took the manuscript and started to read it on the plane on the way home, I said, ooh, I'm seeing this country in a way that I had not been able to see it or feel it when I was actually there. So I was very taken by that privilege of being able to experience something of Saudi Arabia.
And let me tell you that what Tom was seeing in my book, some of our people can't see it now in our lives, because it's telling about the spirit of the country, which we are not aware of it now, as we used to be before.
Why do you say people aren't aware of the spirit of the country, Raja? Raja, are you
Yes, because for example, when I was growing up, I was growing in this atmosphere which was full of poetry and songs, because we are an oral nation who used to transfer our history and legend through poetry. And I used to listen to those while I am a child. Those were our treasures. But as I was growing up, I somehow wanted to disconnect myself from that ancient world, because I thought I would like to be modern. like most people now. And I went into the world and saw different cultures, and afterwards I realized that I have something I should go back to resurrect.
I'm wondering if it would be a useful time for Tom, for me to ask you to choose something from the novel Fatma, just so people get a sense of the type of prose that you and Raja have collaborated on.
Sure. Here's a short passage in which our heroine, Fatma, who's a young woman who's been married off to a snake handler, really first encounters the snakes in her husband's snake farm. She stared at the shadows cast by the snakes and attempted to embroider their fascinating twists and turns on the silk of her abaya. An abaya, I should say, is the gown, or the sort of shroud-like gown that women in this country wear. As she became more familiar with the shadows, she discovered the art of blindness, the art of living in union with unknowable creatures. In their blindness, the snakes seemed to be reaching out to her. This seeming blindness was the first thing Sajir, her husband, had noticed about them, and he had learned how to put their infatuation to good use. Now he put Fatma in charge of his entire eternally twisting collection. It gave him a sense of relief to do this. He felt he'd been waiting all his life for just such a surrender, this shift of power to his wife. Though he never took the trouble to teach her anything about his exotic creatures, she could sense their needs. The knowledge of what their blind souls wanted seemed to be in her blood. They knew where to move, and Fatma knew how to move with them far better than she'd never known how to be with her husband or father. Sajir was astonished at the way the snakes responded to her voice, even when she fed them meals they didn't like. In all his years of tending them, Sajir had never been able to get the black-red creatures to eat frogs unless he went through the process of changing them into rats. But with Fatma, here they were eating insects right out of her hand.
It's Tom McDonough reading from the new book Fatma, written by Raja Alam and Tom McDonough in collaboration. Raja is joining us on the line from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. And Raja, why did you choose snakes?
Because I have this notion. I believe that we are rivers. Our bodies look like as if they are solid, but actually, when we concentrate enough and contemplate, we can reach this liquid state, which we will reach later on, when we after death, for example, or in a dream. So we are this energy, moving energy, and nothing like snakes gives me this feeling, because they are running like rivers, although they are solid. And this is the easiest state for me to be in. And not only snakes. Snakes were just an example of the world which is trying to reach for us. People used to think of Fatma as captive, but I don't think I see her as a captive. I see her as disconnected. She was disconnected with her inner energy. And when she reached that, she knew what she is, and she was able to be transformed. Not only into a snake, but into this great fire and light, which would be eternal.
I want to come back to that idea of Fatma as captive or not captive, because, Tom, when you brought this first manuscript back, The Secret of All Secrets,
yes,
and worked your sort of collaborative translation, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later, you couldn't get a publisher to publish the book.
No, we finished. Took us about a year to finish this first book, and it's set in 17th century Mecca. I showed it to my agent. He said, "This is fabulous. When can you get it over here? When can you start touring?" And I was very excited by that. 22 rejections later, we realized that this book was too strange. We were getting nibbles from publishers saying, "What is this? Is this magic realism?" And we said, "No, it's Arabia." And anyway, in any case, it didn't go. And we got connected with Syracuse University Press, which is an academic press, a university press, that has a line in Middle Eastern books. And they said, we'll do Haza, Haza, Haza. We'll do The Secret of All Secrets. And then about 6 months later, they said, you know, this is a very strange book. Do you have something else? And they decided to do Fatma, which is, it's not unstrange, but it does have a more conventional to Westerners framework than Haza, Haza, Haza. And then since...
I mean, one of the conventions is the idea that the lead character, Fatma, is in many ways imprisoned in the house with the snakes by an abusive husband. And Raja, I'm wondering if perhaps the book appealed to an editor here because the book conformed to some notion that Americans might have of the way that Saudi women live.
Yes, I think so.
Does that bother you?
No, not at all, because I believe that everybody is free to read whatever he wants into any book he bought, he buys. But what I'd like to think of this book is talking about any human being, about me, about anyone, about any man in the West, for example. Because I don't differentiate between men and women. I believe that we all, as a human being, are captive. Not captive, but undiscovered. We are, for example, we don't need to be in a house with an abusive husband to feel captive. We can be free, walking in a Western country and feeling the pressure of the economic state, of the borders, of the political state, to feel captive.
I'm interested in just hearing from you, Raja, whether or not living as you do as a woman in Saudi Arabia, whether or not you feel constrained by the state.
I never felt constrained. For example, if you read my book, you will know that I've never experienced this state of restraint, being restrained, because I write whatever I want, I go wherever I want. I was raised in a very beautiful family. They appreciated whatever I did. And to feel free to write whatever you want, I think this is a real freedom. But after all, I am a human being on this planet. I feel what you are feeling now.
I suspect that your imagination is a little bit more creative than mine. Connection listeners, I'll pick up from where Tom left off in his reading from Fatma. She began to feel a change in the gossamer membrane covering her brain. The silvery curtain relaxed its hidden folds, and the ceiling over her head cleared, and suddenly he could see waves endlessly shining and vanishing. I'm sorry, she could see waves endlessly shining and vanishing, like rivers running merrily in eight directions all at once, breathing together. And Raja talks about people as rivers, liquid energy. You get that kind of creativity in the book. And Connection listeners, when we come back after this break, I'll talk a little bit further with Tom about how you take that sense, that ability to put that on paper in Arabic, in English, and into the book Fatma that you'll be able to read yourself. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And as we continue our series on new writers, new realities, we're interested in hearing from you about whether or not it is through novels like this that we're better able to understand people in other parts of the world. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, thanks.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. With me in the studio, Tom McDonough, co-author of Fatma, and joining us on the line from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, Raja Alem, also co-author of Fatma. She's written six novels in Arabic, published by the Arab Cultural Center for Publishing in Lebanon and Morocco, though Fatma is the first in English and the first available in the United States. I am corrected. It is available on selected bookshelves now. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And as we go through the conversation, Connection listeners, we are interested in hearing from you about whether or not this is the Saudi Arabia that you recognize based on what we normally consume through the pages of the newspaper and the news stories on radio and on television. And Tom, maybe we can just pick up where we were talking a little bit earlier about the way the book was written, because the English you got was not the English that we see in the book right now. What was your role?
Well, I could see, as I read Roger's English, number one, that this is wonderful material, and number two, that she was making the moves that a very good writer makes. She was a real, she was an exceptional writer. I could also see that in terms of the actual words on the page, the putting down of the words, that it was a little bit as if I had attempted to write a book in Spanish with a dictionary at my side.
An English-Spanish dictionary. Yeah,
the words would all be there, but it wasn't right. So I did a very presumptuous thing. Since I love this material very much, I essentially rephrased the first 15 pages or so and faxed them to Raja, whereupon she faxed me right back and said, "This is terrific. This is wonderful. I must tell you, though, that I've started to embroider your initials on a bolt of black cloth in Arabic to make an effective talisman for this project which we're undertaking, but you must supply me, for this to be effective, with your mother's unmarried name," which I did. And we were off. And then I would do maybe 5 pages a week, and she would fax me back and saying, "This is good," or "This is ridiculous. How can you make this mistake?" And we would go back and forth like this. And it was a wonderful way to get to know Roger's culture and to get to know her.
Now, in the afterword to the book that accompanies Fatma, you've given us a bit of a demonstration of what sort of material you'd get in its original state from Raja and then how you transform it. I thought maybe we could just read through a paragraph, perhaps taking turns, to give people an idea of what it was and what it became. Can we do that?
Sure.
Let me start here. "The rivers answered her longing, roaring down the mountains. The Najrani people echoed that roar with their own. Hundreds of colorful men were lined up in the roads, performing Al-Zamel dance to salute the leaving guests.
The rivers, answering her desires, ran faster, foaming. The people of the village cheered. The roads were jammed with brightly robed men dancing Al-Zamel in honor of their departing guests.
Line after line of glowing daggers and flowered heads ebbed and flowed. The dancers moved according to the rhythm, flowing behind the gathering speed truck. Females in black, adorned with silver and red she-camels, which flowed with the hypnotizing drums. The hundreds of hair braids matched camels' saddles, adorned with endless red, yellow, and silver braids.
Behind them stood row upon row of swordsmen and women, flowered headdresses bobbing. The snake truck gathered speed. The dancers high-stepped after it, trailed by women in black, silver anklets jangling, and still more women in yellow gowns, others in flowered skirts, and behind them, swaying to the pounding of the drums, came the camels, silver-braided saddles jingling, echoing the bouncing braids of hundreds and hundreds of women."
Fatma saw the endless lines following on the receding road, following and flowing in her dreams all the way to the city of Mecca. Tareh's last words haunted her. He was there in her black silk, the way he came to her that last night, the way they found him.
From the back of the truck, in what seemed an endless reverie, Fatma watched the crowd of Najranis recede like a backward flowing river rushing toward the holy city of Mecca, so far away. Tara's parting words still rang in her ears. He was with her now, here, in the black silk of her abaya, as he had been with her that night, as he was when they'd found his body.
That's the first version, and the finished version, of a passage from Fatma by Raja Alem and Tom McDonough. And Raja, as you listen to the way it's transformed or transliterated, what's going through your mind?
I always loved Tom's style because it keeps the music I have in my Arabic box. Because when I write my box, I hear sounds in my head. And when I write them, they sound like music. And that music, I hear it now when Tom is reading. It, although I never thought I can capture that in another language.
Can you tell me, Raja, whether or not the type of reading that we're hearing here is similar to other work that's being written in Saudi Arabia, or does your work stand distinct from other writers?
I think my writing is different from every Arabic writing, old Arabic writing. I have this unique, my own style. I don't know if it's good or bad. I'm not a judge of that. But everybody who reads my books know that I am different. Because my writing is not about repeating everyday life. It's about penetrating, about opening doors to next world, to celebrating life. Because when you said a minute ago that I'm more creative than you, I didn't agree with you, because what I'm writing in my books is that we can reach to our real energy, to be eternal beings through doors, either by art or simple joy of life or love or religion or whatever. Everybody has his own way to reach for the real energy inside him. And when we reach those rivers, we will be undiable, we will be eternal. And this is my quest, to be eternal, to go on back between life and death.
Not repeating everyday life, but the quest to be eternal. This is something different.
It is different. I don't know whether your average American novelist would explain his or her ambitions in quite that way. I think that for me, Raja is very interested in connecting, let's say, the sensual world with another world. And we could call it spiritual, we could call it just another realm. And I think this is where the idea of translation or doing a book like this becomes very tricky, because the Raja deals in concepts that we have our versions of. Like we might say that someone who speaks the way Raja just spoke was speaking mystically. But I don't think that's really the case in her culture. It's a very powerful and alive way of thinking in other cultures.
Because I believe so much in the body. I believe we should experience life and afterlife with our spirit and our bodies.
It's a very sensual book that you write. It's very erotic in places. I don't know whether or not it reads the same way in Saudi Arabia as it does once Tom's finished with the English version of it, but I'm sure that's what you intended, Raja.
Yes, because when you said sensual, I live in a sensual atmosphere. My grandmother was sensual. My mother is sensual. Everybody here is enjoying life. When you talk to my mother about women's rights, she would understand only that her life of loving and being happy. And she would love and be was happy all along her life. And I wonder why people tend to think about Saudis are different creatures, because we are all human beings. Saudi Arabia and Congo and in Singapore, we are all the same. They are sensual people, and they are people who didn't discover their sensuality or their bodies.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking about a new book by Raja Alem. It's called Fatma. It's available in English in the United States. We're joined on the line now by Trevor Legasic, who's a professor of Arabic literature at the University of Michigan. Hi, Trevor.
Hello.
Tell me, in your experience, why it is that we see as little of the type of book that that Raja and Tom have worked on as we do?
Well, one of the reasons, obviously, is because her work is as distinctive and unusual as she has suggested it to be.
Mm-hmm.
She is uniquely difficult to read in Arabic. She writes in a very concise, fast-moving, heavily quick-paced style with a considerable use of archaic phrases, and it's really quite difficult to follow her. And this is one reason, that her level of expression and exposition is very unusual. It's deeply culturally embedded and deeply passionate, heavily felt. And all of these aspects, of course, are not that normal in the regular communications prose in which many Arabs write today.
Now, just to be clear, Trevor, you read Raja's work in its original, in the Arabic.
I haven't read it all. I have sampled it here and there.
Right.
At one point, I agreed to work with a translated passage of one work that she had done, and tried to put it into more acceptable English. I saw the Arabic, obviously, and her English, and I did work with both for a period, but it became something too difficult for me to handle at that particular time, and then I understood that Tom was interested in also working on the same manuscript, and he then took over. That's not the same manuscript as has now been published, Fatima, which I haven't read in the Arabic. I have seen the English as of last week, and it's a very impressive piece of writing on Tom's behalf, if I may say so. Although, as I say, I have not seen the Arabic.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and we'll be going into that in a little bit, but also by Studio 180, integrating design and technology to deliver strategically focused websites. On the web at studio180.com. And Schneider Leasing Company, providing short-term computer rental services for conferences, conventions, and special events. 617-261-6060. And Fistacci in Belmont and Boston, roasting more than 40 varieties of nuts and delivering gift baskets with nut assortments, dried fruit, and chocolates. 800-466-3022. It's our year-end fundraiser, right? Day two. And Rob Ailes and I are taking every call we can at 1-800-909-9287 before we go back to The Connection.
Make a contribution of $240 today. That's only $20 a month. We'll thank you with two choice seats to the Huntington Theater Company's Breathe Boom. This is young playwright Kia Corthran's Portrait of Life in a Girl Gang. Breathe Boom is a highly anticipated theater production. Make your pledge of $240 or $20 a month if it's more convenient to give that way. Call 1-800-909-9287 or log on to the website at www.wbur.org.
Absolutely. And whatever the level of your pledging, whether it's the $240 or $120, perhaps $5 a month is what you can do, it's all useful as we make our way through programs like the one you're listening to right now. Pledge for The Connection. Pledge for Here and Now at Noon with Robin Young and Anthony Brooks. These are the people that you listen to regularly because they're dispassionate, they're thoughtful, they're experienced, and they know what they're talking about. 1-800-909-9287 to help pay for the news.
They're there every day for you. We need you to be there right now for us to help pay for the news. 1-800-909-9287.
And because news breaks around the clock, we're here with newscasts at the beginning of every hour featuring breaking news reported by top NPR newscasters, followed by our local newscasts. And so you'll hear Carl Castle, Gene Cochran, Corva Coleman, Gina Cervetti, Bob Oakes, myself, bringing you the news on a regular basis. And then when the news requires much longer perception and longer reportage, you have Morning Edition and All Things Considered and Here and Now at Noon and, of course, The Connection.
And it's every day that you've become accustomed to hearing that news that you value so much. It's not just breaking news. It's the analysis. It's the in-depth pieces. It's the long-form pieces. It's the sound-rich pieces that you've come to love and expect from WBUR. We need you to help us pay for it and help us continue to bring you that news and information programming. Please make a pledge, 1-800-909-9287.
Or on the web at WBUR.org. Rob makes a good point, and that is that that's an expensive kind of news to do. This is not rip and read. These are experienced reporters, writers, producers, editors, engineers, administrative people, development people. For every voice you hear, there are 15 or 20 people behind the scenes bringing this kind of quality to the programming. Isn't that worth a call and a pledge at 1-800-909-9287?
There's a direct connection with how much you value the news and how much you contribute to it to the quality of the news that we're able to bring you. We want to bring you the best talent available. We want to bring you foreign correspondents, people with long careers and deep experience and a wealth of information and perspective, like Tom Ashbrook, like Dick Gordon, people that you come to listen to every day, people that can give you the kind of quality news and information programming you expect. Please go to your phone, make a pledge, 1-800-909-9287.
The unusual program we're listening to now, it's part of the World Literature Series. It's the literature of Saudi Arabia. Dick Gordon's experienced. He's been in the Middle East for years as a reporter for the CBC. And actually, he's been covering that area on his program as well, because the Middle East is a very news-rich area. It's been so much in the news lately. In fact, let's recall some of those moments from The Connection.
Here on The Connection, beyond the soundbites, ahead of the headlines, we bring you a deeper understanding of the forces shaping the Middle East.
With regard to the Saudis, we came from another planet, jumped into right in the middle of the 20th century.
Well, I think Prince Abdullah's right. It was an area that, until the oil age, was rather marginal to world events, to world trade, to population movements. The question of women's role in society is probably the biggest one that separates us culturally.
In the case of Iran, there is a demographic shift that has taken place. Over 45% of the population is under the age of 21.
Any intervention by the U.S. is a kind of kiss of death. The best thing that American can do, and it is not overtly supporting one side against the other, because that really doesn't do them any favors.
I think Iraq needs now to look into engaging more people in the political process. If we've learned anything from the last 35 years, it is not that Saddam has failed. I think the model of trying to rule a country by force, totally relying on a strong man in a central government, this model has failed.
I'm Dick Gordon. We need your help to continue our coverage of events around the world. Please call now with your pledge. Here's the number.
1-800-909-9287. That gets you through, and it means that the kind of programming you're hearing now, which you can't find anywhere else, will keep coming your way. You'll be joining supporters like Ned Numina, partnering with financial companies to transform Business Connection.
New writers, new realities. Connection listeners, my name's Dick Gordon. We're continuing our series looking at literature from parts of the world that we don't hear from, see that much of, and you'll know if you've been with us on the journey. We've been in South Africa, and we've been in Russia, and we've been exploring Mexico. Today, Saudi Arabia, with the writer Raja Alem, who's on the line with us from Riyadh, and although it's not a great telephone line, so you'll have to bear with us. With me in the studio, Tom McDonough, who worked with Raja Alem on the first of her books to be published in the United States. It's called Fatma. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. And we're going to Madison, Wisconsin. Susan's joining us. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Hi. I am really excited. I haven't heard, I've missed the other episodes that you've had in this series. I have to check those out, too. But
they're all on the web.
This sounds absolutely fascinating. I mean, even if it's difficult to read, one can read something for, well, like I still haven't finished Remembrance of Things Past, but I still go back to it. It's always worth it. And this is just so fascinating. One thing that attracts me to this book is if I understood the spiritual dimension and combining that with sensuality. I am having trouble here understanding what Raja says, and I hope she understands that some of us American listeners will misunderstand her here and there. And
I'll tell you what, if you get your hands on the book, you'll read a style of feminism that will be quite new to you. It's a part of the book that we haven't really talked that much about. But
really, Tom,
in a way,
Tell me something. I am a Christian. And I have had to deal with the problem of feminism for Christians. I mean, you know, the Apostle Paul, whom I dearly love, but he didn't understand women. Believe me, he really didn't understand women. And yet he said, in Christ there is no male or female. And then he gave all these rules that made distinctions. But that overarching spiritual truth is there. It's there to see. Is Raja's feminism anything like that? That, yeah, there are all these distinctions. Women have to dress differently. They have to stay in the house or whatever. But I can't go into my church without a skirt on. I can't wear pants, even feminine pants that no man would wear.
Let me interrupt you if I can, Susan, and ask Tom on this aspect of the feminism that you and Raja collaborated on, whether or not you find it as something that actually does cross borders and cultures in this case.
Well, yes. Raja has said that, and I must say, I feel a little
It's
odd,
okay.
Answering.
You are speaking for her.
Yeah. The notion of borders, whether they're borders of gender or place, is something that Raja plays with all the time, and I think she would insist that the borders are there. Only in a semi-illusory sense. As far as feminism goes, that's a word that means something to you and me and to our listeners in the West. It means many things. I think in what Raja conveys in that respect to me is a beautiful sense of the force of women and men together. The electricity, if you will, is there. This is very humid writing. It's very, very
steamy. Would work.
It's steamy, there's a very affirmative sense of, let's say, the anima, as Jung might say. It's a very affirmative sort of female philosophy, if you will.
I wonder, Trevor Legasic, if I can just turn to you and ask you to pull the lens back a little bit here, because as I listen to Susan's enthusiasm for the type of storytelling that Raja has, and it occurs to me how little of what may be published in Arabic, in the Arab world, is available in English, in North America. Is that an accurate observation?
It used to be the case 10-15 years ago. Certainly there was relatively little available for us to read in English. In that intervening 10-15 year period, a great deal of material has now appeared. It has very small readerships, generally speaking. University presses are sometimes involved, sometimes commercial publishers. But there is a lot of material available at this point to read from Arabic in translation, and usually in good, close translation, readers are recommended to try to find it.
I mean, beyond Naguib Mahfouz, the Nobel Prize winner from Egypt, you're saying that that this is something we're already seeing more of on our bookshelves.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, there's a lot of materials out there. A whole range of writers are now available in the English language who are Arabic in original writing.
Because I'm thinking of the UN report, which said that, in fact, there was, in comparative terms, not much being written and less being translated.
Well, I'm not sure what date that statement came, but the current reality is that there are a large number of works available in English translation. I've done several myself, for example, other than Mahfouz, and they are out there. It's readerships are small. These works often do not get reviewed in major national publications, and therefore the general audience doesn't get to hear about them. But they are out there, and they certainly make extraordinarily interesting reading and give us insights into Arab culture and the world out there with which we're so closely these days intimately connected, that are quite different from the normal impressions and entrees that we receive through political scientists and journalists and so on.
Would you say, Tom, that there's a greater appetite today than a year, two, 5 years ago.
Well, I think there's more. Yes, there's more appetite. Whether there's appetite for fiction in the Arab world about the Arab world or from the Arab world is a question. I think there's a great appetite for stories, the kind of story you see in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times.
You know what, though? I've had it up to here with those. That's what I liked about the book, was that having had, for the past 16 months, nothing but here's what you need to know and should have been reading all along, put in the newspaper, that to sort of dive into something which is so radically different and yet of the same world. That, to me, was the treat.
Yeah, I think one of the things about Roger's writing is that it is exotic to us, but on the other hand, it is real on-the-ground experience of Arabia. I read Roger's work, I say, this is what it's like. I read a New York Times article, and I say, well, maybe. But this is the Arab experience in Roger's work.
1-800-423-8255. Susan, thanks for your call. We're going to Milwaukee now, and Diane's waiting. Hi, Diane.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I've enjoyed the show, but I have a question. She says she's like most Muslim women. She is loved and is happy and not much for women's rights. But most of the Muslim women don't read and write in Arabic, much less English, or English, much less Arabic. And from what I've read, none of them would be able to collaborate with a male to write a book. I just see something doesn't fit in my mind. Can you clarify that?
Just stay on the line. Let's let Raja answer. And Raja, I'm not sure if the phone line's clear enough, but the question is in essence.
Yes, it is clear.
Okay, go ahead.
What I'd like to clear is that there's a big difference between illiteracy and ignorance. And most, for example, the generation of my mother and grandmother were illiterate, but they were by no means ignorant. For example, they memorized the poetry, the legend, and they were memorized 1001 Nights, and they were telling us all that. And you can see now people who are having a PhD or a PhD degree and so on, and they are ignorant.
So what you're saying is just because you speak English or just because...
English or Arabic. You don't need to read English or Arabic. You need to be aware of the life around you. You can learn a lot from one grain of sand. And my mother and me also, I don't perceive the world through reading only or listening to TV or so on, but through experiencing life. And we can learn a lot from life.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
And you're listening to the alternative viewpoints that we talk about when we ask you to support WBUR at 1-800-909-9287. I don't believe I've ever heard anyone make the case that you can be illiterate but not ignorant, that you're not ignorant if you're illiterate, because you can learn in many other ways. That was the woman's response to a caller who had said, I understand that many Arab women, Muslim women, do not read or write, and therefore. So this is the kind of connection that you can't find anywhere else. This is the kind of information that you can't get anywhere else. And that's why in our year-end fundraiser, Rob Ailes and I are taking every call we can at 1-800-909-9287.
Every day on The Connection, you are encouraged to be involved in the conversations. You can call, you can participate, you can listen. And each day, hour after hour, more information is shared, layers are revealed, and more information is brought to you in depth, in detail, in an ongoing way. Make a pledge right now to support that news that you've come to depend on and expect from WBUR, 1-800-909-9287.
Or you can pledge on the web, if that's more convenient, at wbur.org. But whatever the level of your participation, $5 a month, $10 a month, $20 if you can do it, the important thing is that you're joining the thousands of fellow listeners who supply more than half the support needed to keep WBUR running. And you're voting with your dollars. You're saying, we want you to keep doing what you're doing, Dick Gordon, or Here and Now, which is coming up next, or Fresh Air with Terry Gross. 1 800-909-9287.
And there is a direct connection to how good the quality of the news is that we can bring to you day in, day out, throughout the coming year, and to how much you are able to and willing to step forward and contribute to make it happen. Step forward, make that pledge, 1-800-909-9287. Today we've got a great limited edition fleece jacket for a gift of $365, or just a dollar a day for that service you've come to value so much. Make that pledge, give a dollar a day, get a fleece jacket as our thanks, 1-800-909-9287.
Every pledge you make helps pay for the news and for the in-depth news. For example, let's take the Middle East. We were just listening to a discussion of Saudi Arabian literature. Let's go back over some of the moments of that huge news story over the year and just relive a little bit of what your pledge pays for at 1-800-909-9287.
At least 11 people were killed today and scores wounded when a Palestinian suicide bomber blew himself up on a bus in Jerusalem during morning rush hour.
There was confusion in the small emergency room as victims of the blast lay on stretchers in the hall and family members raced in looking for their relatives. 17-year-old Lonnie Gino looked dazed as she held a conference to her.
Several hundred friends and relatives have come to the cemetery to say goodbye. The black-draped coffins are wheeled in on gurneys, one full-size, one small. On top of both are bouquets of white roses. Chen Kanaan pushes herself out of the wheelchair. She rests her forearms on her daughter's...
As Israelis gathered at funerals for some of the seven victims of the latest suicide bombings, Israel made sure that Arafat and his aides experienced the roar and smell of high explosives at very close range.
Last Wednesday, Israeli troops came and photographed the house, the first hint they were going to destroy it. At midnight, they returned with explosives. When Yusuf Sarasra challenged them, he says Israeli soldiers replied they weren't happy about the assignment.
They were polite. I said to you, polite.
Said White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer. Is the Sharon government's military success worth the civilian death and political backfire? And how should Washington assess the cost and benefit of this unending conflict to U.S. interests in the Middle East?
That, of course, was Tom Ashbrook, and it's just an example of the montage of events that we bring you, not just from the Middle East, but all over the world, and that we're asking you to support. You're joining folks like the Games People Play, offering a wide selection of board games, table games, chess sets, backgammon, card games, puzzles, and toys, not on the web, on Mass Ave, just outside Harford Square. And Museum of Fine Arts, presenting the photography of Charles Sheeler, rare prints by a major American photographer, on view through February 2nd. Information at mfa.org. And the White Star Tavern, Copley Square, serving food until midnight every night, now booking holiday parties for up to 75 people in their mezzanine, 617-536-4477.